There's a verse I wanted to mention up here about God allowed Israel to have a spirit of stupor. You remember that verse in Romans 11, 8? Oh, wait, I got that wrong too. God gives Israel a spirit of stupor. Okay, let's go back to Ecclesiastes 1:13. Listen to what this is saying. It is an experience of evil Elohim has given the sons of humanity to humble them by it. Given. Active. God giving you evil. God doesn't bring evil on anyone. Yes, He does. He gives it to you to humble you. And it works, doesn't it? Little things. I read this somewhere that psychiatrists did a study. And they say that it's not the traumatic events in your life that break you down. Somehow you get a hidden strength. It's the little details. When you drop an M&M and you can't find it. Did it ever happen to you? Where in the world can I just drop? Now, where did it go? What did it do? Roll to China? Now, I am very serious. People think you're being glib. I am not. That just killed. You find it under the couch. It's 20 yards away. That stuff drives me nuts. And it's one thing after another all day long like that. Little tiny things. And this comforts me to know that God has given me this. You see, God's got a planet to spin. You don't have time to worry about where your M&M is. He caused it to roll under the couch. I'm that serious. I am dead serious. Because that's an irritant that humbles me. I go nuts at the end of the day because of these little things that go wrong. I put my bike up and the tire's flat. Or whatever. My toner runs out on my computer right when I need it. He has given me that to humble me, and it works. I'm humble. I'm humble. I'm humbled already. If anybody wants some back issues of the Idle Babbler Illustrated, I've got them back there, the ones that were published this year. So take some, give them to your soon-to-be ex-friends. And I have some tapes back there that I think are particularly helpful. One is Salvation Free or Isn't It? I think this is a good tape to give to somebody who hasn't heard this yet. It starts with a phone call between me and Elmer Fudd. So it's not your typical fare, but I think it'll help get the truth across. And I got another one in there called Purpose of the Ten Commandments. So if you want to pick up those, pick them up, take them, pass them around. Please do that. I appreciate the messages this morning, Coy and Phil. Just great. So now I'm going to ruin everything. No, I'm not. I am excited about this message. I'm excited to talk about this. Does God care if a little boy throws a snowball? Such an insignificant little thing. God has a universe to run. God has planets to spin. What does He care if a little boy throws a snowball? I want to ask you something else. Do you think God cares if a man changes his seat in a theater because he can't see the play from where he is? A man gets up and changes his seat. A minor detail. What does God care for it? I wonder if God cares if a man in an Italian rifle factory is having a bad day and he makes a rifle with the scope misaligned by a couple millimeters. Whether he's had an argument with his wife or he didn't get enough sleep that night, he places a scope on a Italian Mannlicher Carcano rifle, 6.5 millimeter, and that rifle ends up at a Chicago sporting goods store called Klein's Sporting Goods. Little details, I wonder if God cares. My talk today is entitled, God, it's a bold title, God Causes Everything. This world is made up of little insignificant, seemingly insignificant details that have major implications. Every chain of events is only as strong as the weakest link. Now I'm going to play Paul Harvey, and I'm going to give you the rest of the story. I asked you if God cares if a little boy throws a snowball. Well, the date was March 5th, 1770, beneath a state house in Boston, Massachusetts. And a boy threw a snowball at a British soldier. And the British opened fire. We call it the Boston Massacre today. Some historians point to this as the initial skirmish of the Revolutionary War because a boy threw a snowball. Does God care if a boy throws a snowball? I think so. Does God care if a man changes his seat because he can't see the action on the stage? The man's name was John F. Parker. He was watching a play called Our American Cousin. The play was being held in Washington, D.C. The date was April 14th, 1865. And the man was guarding the box where Abraham Lincoln was sitting. And John F. Parker could not see the play from his seat behind the door where the president was. And he went to where he could see the play. And he left the president unguarded. Now, John Wilkes Booth was ready for the guard because he had a knife. He was ready to dispatch the guard. But he didn't have to. You know what? That would have caused some kind of a scuffle, wouldn't it? And there was a strong man sitting with the president and his wife. Henry Reed Rathbone was his name. And he was a strong man. And he would have heard that, and he might have had a chance to protect the president. But because a man changed his seat, a course of history has changed. What about that poor guy having a bad day at the Italian rifle factory? He misaligns the scope by a couple millimeters. That rifle ends up at a place called Klein Sporting Goods, Chicago. It's ordered by a man named A. Hiddell. A. Hiddell. But that's an alias. The man's real name is Lee Harvey Oswald. And he opens a P.O. box at the post office across the street from the Texas School Book Depository. And he gets this rifle. And did you know in the Warren Report, Volume 3, said that that scope was misaligned. And the misalignment of the scope might have helped Oswald to hit the president. We know that Oswald was a good shot in the Marines. He has good scores. But you're obviously going to be nervous, a little upset, when you're taking aim at the president of the United States. And the Warren Report says that that misaligned scope might have helped him. Oswald missed the president, but for the scope was misaligned by a couple millimeters, and he hit the president of the United States. And we told you last night in Romans 13 that the powers that be are put there by God. Abraham Lincoln was succeeded by Andrew Johnson. John F. Kennedy was succeeded by Lyndon Baines Johnson. God put those men where they were. That tells me that God was behind the evil that put them there. Because this was an event that has a chain. Everything is linked together. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. You know, I used to think that God was not in control of every little detail. But then I used to think that the faces on Mount Rushmore was a natural rock phenomenon too. How often do you hear this, Rick, Coy? We go down to Florida for the conference, you know. And Dolores is here and Jack's here. We always seem to talk about the same thing. One of those things is the little things. And you always hear this. You mean to tell me that if I scratch my ear, you've heard that, God caused that. You mean to tell me that if I burp, God planned that ahead of time. Well, let me tell you, a burp can change your life. No, I'm serious. I am serious. I don't think my dad will ever hear this tape, so I can talk about him, all right? Now, when my dad was a kid, I mean, you always get these little examples. When my dad was a kid, he burped at the table, like all kids do. Well, his dad, he remembers this to this day. It happened, what, 50, 55 years ago? His dad reached over and knocked him off his chair. Now, that had a major impression on my dad. And don't you think that that probably had something to do with the way he raised his kids? It changed his life. He remembered it 55 years after it happened. A burp can change your life. Now, there's a guy in our town. He was in a van. He was driving down the road in a van. And his little girl, something was not adjusted well with the car seat. And he reached over for a fraction of a second to tighten the seat, and he killed a pedestrian in my hometown. I heard of a story of a girl in Amish country. When I live in Ohio, we have some Amish country. And the hills, they go up and down. A teenager reached to adjust the radio volume because it wasn't just right. And in that fraction, killed an Amish. A family. Because the radio wasn't the right volume. Now, you're telling me that major events do not consist of little events. And unless God controls the little events, the big events do not fall into place. That's why I take a bold stance here, and I'll stand by it, and I got scriptures for you. God causes everything. Paul says in Acts 17:28, in Him we are living and moving and are. That's what Paul told the heathen philosophers. Now, in Him we are living. Okay, a lot of people believe that. We live because of God. A lot of people can believe that. But at least they say, well, I can move apart from God. I have some freedom to move. No, in Him we're living and moving. Okay, well, I'll show you. I won't move. And are. If you're alive, you're in Him. It's by Christ. It's by God. You see the progressive control there? In Him we're living. In Him we're moving. In Him we are. These are major things. Folks, when you scratch your ear, that could have world-changing implications. You scratch your ankle, you could wreck your car. The world can change. These are major. Of course God planned this ahead of time. He's God. You know what the word God means? I just got to write it on the board to remind you. Subjector. He subjects. Psalm 130. Let's go microscopic. Why ask these are gross movements. Scratching of my ear, the scratching of my nose. These are gross movements. Of course God controls these. Psalm 139:13. Let's get microscopic here. For you yourself achieved the making of my innermost being. This is David speaking. You yourself achieved the making of my innermost being. You overshadowed me in my mother's belly. What decides whether you're born a male or a female? We got these little things in the cells called chromosomes, don't we? 48 chromosomes in each cell made up of 24 pairs. And the female type person, she's got 24 pairs that are exactly alike. They're called autosomes. And the male type folks, he's got 23 pairs that are alike. But in the reproductive cell, he's got one pair with an X and a Y chromosome. It's called heterochromosomes. And these determine, the woman has two X, these, the X and the Y, which one enters the egg depends on the gender of the human being. And don't you think God controls the gender of a human being? And in order to control the gender of a human being, He has to direct which of these chromosomes, which you can't even see with the naked eye, make it to that female reproductive cell. This is microscopic. And we're asking, does God control when I scratch my ear? Let's go deeper. DNA. The double helix. Heredity. David says, you yourself. He emphasized it. In case there's any doubt, you yourself achieved. God did it. God did it. You achieved the making of me in my mother's womb. Our Lord said that the very hairs on your head are numbered. Does God care about insignificant things? Is He too busy running the universe to care how many hairs are on your head? No. He says in Matthew 10, verses 29, that He knows when a sparrow falls. But it's more than that. It's more than just knowing. Because in the 104th Psalm, we read that when God sends His Spirit, a creature lives. And when He withdraws His Spirit, the creature returns to the soil. God causes sparrows to die. Who holds the keys of death? God says, Christ says, Revelation 1:18, I hold the keys of death. Dying is not an accident. And this is bold to talk this way. I understand that. God causes people to die. It's hard to make yourself say that word, causes. But this is a very scriptural word. I had somebody ask me one time, turned around and said to me, which God is greater? The God who gives you a little bit of freedom or a dictator? And I said, the dictator. Just because we associate, dictator has bad associations, folks. Whenever you hear dictator, who do you think of? Thank you. Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini. That's our problem. If we think of these vile characters, a dictator is one who dictates. You know what dictate means? To say, to speak. God speaks and it comes into being. God is a benign dictator. I want no other dictatorship. If God isn't a dictator, He's not God. We were talking about this at breakfast. God does not react to things. God is not a reactor. He doesn't wait and see what's going to happen and then move in and fix it. God is a causer. And this is very hard to get this word to come out of our mouths sometimes, because we feel we have to apologize for God, don't we? Because of some of the things He does. God does not just start the ball rolling and then wait to see what happens. God takes a stand in His own congregation. And He is vitally involved. What does this chart say? All is out of God. We're into that, right? We all agree with that. Romans 11:36. All is for God. We like that. All is through God. Sometimes we have a hard time with that. But it's a package deal. The word allow is a wimpy word. I don't like the word allows. But we so often slip into this word to make an excuse for God. Well, God allowed this to happen. But I want to ask you something. Jack, you live down there in Florida where they process fruit, right? Here's a fruit processing belt. And you got the oranges running down the line. Okay? And there's a checker, isn't there? There's a person that stands at the fruit belt and they take out the bad ones and they allow some to go through. And others they don't allow. Now, if we relegate God to a position of one who allows some things and disallows other things, where's the stuff coming from? You see what I mean? If God is merely one who allows things to happen, where's the stuff coming from? Yet I read 2 Corinthians 5:18 that all is out of God. 1 Corinthians 8:6, the Father out of whom all is. Romans 11:36, all is out of God. He's not a checker at the belt, allowing some things and not allowing others. He is the cause of all causes. He started it, and He is doing it, and He is going to finish it. I'd like the word allow to be eliminated from our vocabulary when speaking about God, because it dethrones Him as the source. I found a great verse on this in Job. Chapter 37, verse 13. Listen to this. Whether it be for a club that He fulfills His approved plan, or for benignity, it is He who causes it to occur. There's your verse, if you want one. If you want a verse on it, there it is. Whether it be for a club, that he fulfills his plan. Job says, whether it be for evil, whether he does an evil, or whether he does a good, it is he who causes it to occur. None of this allows stuff with Job. And here, speaking of Job, people use Job a lot to say that, well, God allowed Satan to do this to Job. You hear that with Job, don't you? Well, God, he had to get permission from God. God allowed him, as if this is Satan's brainchild. Satan had this great idea, and God's thinking about it, and, okay, I guess I'll let this go through. That's not the story. I got the concordant version of Job, which is being published in installments in Unsearchable Riches magazine. And in chapter 1, verse 8, we read this. So Yahweh said to the adversary, have you set your heart on my servant Job? It was God's idea. I hope he doesn't mention my name to the adversary. Have you considered my servant Job? Adversary, wow, you know, I really haven't thought about this much. God wanted something to happen with Job. Adversary is sometimes wiser than some believers. Because the adversary says to God in verse 11, nevertheless, now put forth your hand and touch all that is his. Adversary knows it has to come from God. Because adversary knows it all's out of God. Adversary can't come up with some brilliant plan and then get God's approval, God's permission. He knew that it had to come out of God. So the adversary says, put forth your hand. It's not my hand. I can't make anything happen. I'm not a cause of all things. It's of God that it said God has planned it. Who can frustrate it? Isaiah 14:27. So the adversary says, put forth your hand. And this is very interesting. Verse 12. Hence, Yahweh said to the adversary, behold, all that he has is in your hand. Interesting, huh? Adversary says, put forth your hand. God says, all right, all he has is in your hand. It starts in God's hand. The adversary recognized that, and now the adversary, or God, is passing it to the adversary's hand. You're right, God says, it is in my hand to touch him. Now it's in your hand. Go and do it. Go and do it. He dispatched the adversary. He didn't allow the adversary. We got to change the way we present God. God does not need any PR men. Somebody says, well, if I tell people this, they're going to think, what are they going to think of God? Well, you better not give them the Bible. Phil was talking about a verse about the, I think it's in 1 Samuel chapter 15, when Saul was to slaughter the Amalekites. If you're going to hand the Bible to somebody and tell them to read it, maybe you ought to just kind of rip that page out of what God asked Saul to do. God doesn't need any PR men. He doesn't need us to put a good face on him. He needs us to teach the truth. And believe me, the truth is not popular. I got more verses for you. Amos 4:7. And moreover, I withhold from you the downpour while still 3 months from harvest. And I cause rain on one city, and on another city I am not causing rain. I got about 40 verses on the word cause. I don't got any verses on the word allows. This is daring to talk this way. I understand that. And do you think I like it sometimes? No. Do you think I like what God does? No. Don't mistake. Don't think this is some glib thing where I'm coming up here and saying, God does everything. Aren't we happy with it? It's wonderful. No. A friend of mine was killed on a bicycle. And I hate death. I hate it. Because it's an enemy. But my comfort was that God caused it. If I thought for a second that the adversary had originated that plan for my friend, I would have no peace. But after the tears are done, and after you've pounded the steering wheel, and after you've cried out to God, it is a rock-solid comfort whether it be for a club or for benignity, it is He who causes it to occur. And believe it or not, that's a comfort when you really wrap around it. Isaiah 45:17, I, the Lord, allow evil. Wait a minute, I think I'm misquoting that. What version was I reading? Maybe that was a new inconsistent version. That's the NIV. I create evil. Oh, we can't tell people that. What are they going to think about God if we tell them that? Well, maybe there's a time not to tell it. Maybe there's a time not to tell it. But for goodness sake, let's not say that He doesn't. Let's not say that He's not the cause. David understood this. Phil brings out some great things about David. Boy, and here's one, Psalm 66, verse 10. You bring us, here's a man who understood God's control. You bring us into a fastness. You place pressure on our waists. You cause a mortal to ride over our head. You cause a mortal to ride over our head. I like the way David's pretty hip. This guy's riding me. We thought that was a modern term. You cause this guy to do it. Remember when Shimei came and cursed David, when David's fleeing Jerusalem from Absalom? Abishai, one of David's fighting men with him, said, let's cut off his head. That was his answer. David says, let him curse, for the Lord has told him. This agrees perfectly with what he says in Psalm 66. God caused that mortal to hassle me. He didn't allow it. Well, guess God allowed this to come into my life. No, He didn't. He caused it. Because He has your good in mind. And He's operating all together for good. Scriptures promise us that. So why shouldn't we believe He caused it? Romans 9:18, to whom He will, He is merciful. To whom He will, He is hardening. We all know that. Exodus 7:3, I myself shall harden the heart of Pharaoh. I love this. I myself. In case there's any doubt, let me reiterate this. I myself will harden the heart of Pharaoh. Yet somehow we still can't have a hard time wrapping around that. Romans 9:19, who has withstood His intention? Oh, here's a good one. Here's a good one. Psalm, I just saw this in here. I'm sure this psalm has been in there for a while. I just saw it. Psalm 105:25, He turned their heart to hate His people. Speaking of the Egyptians. Isn't that an amazing verse? He turned their heart to hate. Oh, you can't be telling me God caused people to hate. Yeah, He does. He causes people to hate to fulfill His intention. That's mighty strong doctrine. That's mighty strong medicine. But when you let it sink in, it is medicine. Isaiah must have been drunk when he wrote this. Isaiah 63:17. Why art thou leading us astray, Yahweh, from thy ways? Either he was drunk or he was filled with the Spirit and understood God's control. Why art thou leading us astray? God doesn't lead anybody astray. The person leads himself astray. Person's got freedom and he leads himself astray when he disobeys God. Lord, why art thou leading us astray, making us indurate to thy fear? Indurate, just a fancy concordant word there for hard. Making us hard to thy fear. Here's a good one too. Zephaniah. I'm giving you some great verses here. Zephaniah 1:17. I cause distress for humanity. I cause distress for humanity. Boy, does he ever. But he's doing it for a purpose, to bring humanity to him. If he did it for sport, we don't have a God. If he does it because he's got something great in mind, it can be learned no other way than he's a genius, isn't he? And there's a place in Ezekiel where it says, I just love this verse, it says, God will be just. I will be justified for all the evil I have brought this people. And boy, you know who brought Israel all their trouble? God did. And he said, I'll be justified for all the evil I have brought against this people. Well, God, I don't see it. Well, you're just not supposed to walk by perception on this one, because you're going to see it later. You have to walk by faith now. Ecclesiastes 1:13. This is such a comfort to me. Listen to this out of the Tentative Concordant Version. Ecclesiastes 1:13. It is an experience of evil Elohim has given the sons of humanity to humble them by it. Given. There's a verse I wanted to mention up here about God allowed Israel to have a spirit of stupor. You remember that verse in Romans 11:8? No, wait, I got that wrong too. God gives Israel a spirit of stupor. Okay, let's go back to Ecclesiastes 1:13. Listen to what this is saying. It is an experience of evil Elohim has given the sons of humanity to humble them by it. Given. Active. God giving you evil. God doesn't bring evil on anyone. Yes, He does. He gives it to you to humble you. And it works, doesn't it? Little things. I read this somewhere that psychiatrists did a study. And they say that it's not the traumatic events in your life that break you down. Somehow you get a hidden strength. It's the little details. When you drop an M&M and you can't find it. Did that ever happen to you? Where in the world can I just drop? Now, where did it go? What did it do? Roll to China? Now, I am very serious. People think you're being glib. I am not. That just killed. You find it under the couch, 20 yards away. That stuff drives me nuts. And it's one thing after another all day long like that. Little tiny things. And this comforts me to know that God has given me this. You say, God's got a planet to spin. He don't have time to worry about where your M&M is. He caused it to roll under the couch. I'm that serious. I am dead serious. Because that's an irritant that humbles me. I go nuts at the end of the day because of these little things that go wrong. I pump my bike up and the tire's flat. Or whatever. My toner runs out on my computer right when I need it. He has given me that to humble me, and it works. I'm humble. I'm humbled already. I've got to hit this. There's a lot of confusing doctrines that have come from a misunderstanding of the absolute and the relative perspectives. I wrote about this in the Idle Babbler Illustrated. But this is a key, this is so key to understanding it that I want to hit it again briefly. When I say an absolute perspective, what do I mean? Absolute means you're looking at the highest viewpoint of something you possibly can. It is the ultimate cause. A relative viewpoint is a limited viewpoint as far as man can see. For instance, here's two people, it's starting to rain, and they're looking at the rain. One guy's name is Bill, the other guy's name's Bentley. Somebody asks these guys, where'd this rain come from? Bentley says, well, rain came from that cloud. Rain's coming from that cloud. Is he right? Yeah, he's right. But Bentley says, no, I got a scripture verse in, that one in Amos 4:7, God causes it to rain. That rain came from God. Which one's right? Did it come from the cloud or did it come from God? They're both right, but one is a relative perspective, which is Bentley's view. Rain came from the cloud. That's all he can see as far as what he's relating to. But Bill took the higher viewpoint and said the rain ultimately has a cause. That cloud don't produce rain by itself. It has power behind it, and that power is God's power. God is the cause of all. That's the absolute and perspective, the absolute and the relative perspective. But it's confusing in the scriptures when we find Jesus Christ relating to men. He says, seek and you shall find. That must mean that I have a free will. I can seek if I want. But Paul says no one's seeking after God. Are Jesus and Paul at cross purposes? Jesus says, come to me, all you are heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Come to me if you're heavy laden, I'll give you rest. But then later our Lord says, no one can come to me unless the Father draws him. Joshua said, choose this day whom you will serve. There's a biggie, right? That's the biggie people use to so-called prove free will. Choose this day whom you will serve. What does Paul say? Or what did our Lord say to his disciples? You have not chosen me, I choose you. These seem to be contradictions, don't they? Jesus looks over Jerusalem. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, killing the prophets and stoning those I send you. How I would have loved to have gathered you as a hen gathers her brood, but you would not. That proves it. They had free will because he said they would not. But Paul says God gives Israel a spirit of stupor. What's the deal? Here's the deal. Jesus Christ is in the ballpark with man. He is dealing with men. And this he's a human being. And he hurts and he cries and he bleeds. And he says, come to me, come to me. But he knows that on top of that, no one can come unless the Father sends him. But he's relating to men. He's operating all through the gospel. Not all through, but in a lot of the gospel accounts, according to the relative viewpoint. Jesus is relating to man. We're seeing action on a stage. Paul takes us above the stage and tells us why these things are happening. You know, clocks don't run by themselves. You might go and on the city hall, you got this real impressive clock, don't you? On the wall of the city hall. And you stare at that clock. Wow, look at those hands moving around. That's a marvel. That is a marvel. What's not so marvelous? If you look behind it, you're going to see a big battery or a big gears. There's a cause for that clock moving. What you see is the relative perspective. Why it's happening is the absolute perspective. So since blue is the color of God here, I'm going to use a blue marker. This is God. This is 2 Corinthians 5:18. All is out of God. This is 1 Corinthians 8:6. The Father out of whom all is. This is Romans 11:36. All is out of God. Daniel 4:35. He causes whatever happens on the earth or the heavens. God causes it. Isaiah 14:27. He's planned it. Who can frustrate it? God all-encompassing. However, there is a doctrine that states this, that within this circle of God's control, there is another circle within it, and that is man. It's the old fly in the bottle doctrine. You've heard it. Yeah, God does have control of everything, but within that control, we have a little bit of freedom to do things. We can either please God or displease God. And within this control, yeah, we admit God's in control of everything, but, well, He's not really, there's this little sphere where man operates. And it's the old fly in the bottle. God's got the bottle, and you can, the fly has a certain amount of freedom within the bottle. Or it's the dog on the leash. The dog has a certain amount of freedom in the leash. But there is a little realm where that fly or that dog can operate apart from God's control. Because the human has to be able to make decisions, you see, or God can't judge him. That's the theory. But that's wrong. Because what we have done here, by drawing a circle around here, we have shut out God. What we're doing here is looking at the clock, at the hands on the clock, and we're looking at the relative viewpoint, and we're saying that the relative is the absolute. And we're drawing, and this is what condemns this doctrine, is by drawing this sphere around. Because as soon as you do that, there's a little sphere that God can't get in. He's repelled because there's this little bit of freedom. Now, those who propose this thought, that we have a little bit of freedom, they put it inside the greater circle of God just to give it some sort of scriptural, to make it give a scriptural look. They do it for cosmetic purposes. Because really, as long as you have this circle, you can put it anywhere. You can put it outside the circle. You can put it up here. As soon as you've enclosed this, you can put it anywhere. The only reason it's put inside here is to give it some kind of cosmetic effect to make it look like it's a scriptural doctrine, to make it look like God is in control. But if there's one tiny little speck of control God doesn't have, then He's not the absolute subjector. This is fiction. This is looking at the relative viewpoint and assuming it's the absolute viewpoint. Do you remember that poem about those Indians? A gentleman who felt the elephant, they were blind, those blind men. And one guy takes a hold of the elephant's tail. He says, "I got it, guys, elephant's like a rope." Other guy takes a hold of his ear. "No, no, an elephant is like a fan." The other guy's banging on the elephant's flank. He says, gentlemen, an elephant is like a wall." Men have taken hold of these relative verses, "Seek and you shall find, come to me, choose this day whom you will serve." And they have assumed that this is the elephant. They have assumed that this is an absolute sphere where man operates. What they don't understand is it's part of the whole picture. It is part of the whole. It is not an isolated element by itself. Because as soon as you do this, you say that man's action has no cause. As soon as you look at that clock on the wall and marvel at the hands without appreciating the power behind it, you have said that this has no cause apart from man. God cannot enter this sphere. And you know, the big part is, the reason this crops up is because man does not understand how God can still hold you accountable if He caused you to do it. Well, what you're telling me is that God causes me to do what I do. That's right, that's what I'm telling you. Then why does God still hold me accountable? Why do I come into judgment? Well, somebody asked, Paul proposed that very question, didn't he? This is a legitimate question. Romans chapter 9. You'll be protesting to me. Paul says he is merciful to whom he is merciful. He is hardening whom he will be hardening. And Paul is anticipating this argument. You will be protesting to me. I see it coming. Why is he still blaming? If God hardened Pharaoh's heart, why does he still blame Pharaoh? The problem is when we think blaming is bad. And Paul's answer is, oh man, who are you to question what God does? God indeed still judges those he causes to withstand his intention. Paul brings up the same argument in Romans chapter 3. Paul says, if our injustice is commending God's righteousness, what shall we declare? That God, who is bringing on indignation, is unjust? In other words, Paul's saying that our injustice, the injustice of Israel, is commending God's righteousness. And it is. God made Israel hard for a purpose to commend His righteousness. So Paul's asking, why is God still going to judge Israel if He made him hard? And the human mind reels at this, and it's rejected out of hand, and so this is invented. Well, there must be, in order for God to judge, there must be this at least little bit of sovereign sphere where we can at least please God or not please God. No. And I don't have time, but I would love to go to Isaiah chapter 10, because there we read of the king of Assyria. God said, I bring the king of Assyria against my people. I cause them to run roughshod over my people. But God says, I will judge the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria. He said, the king of Assyria doesn't realize that I'm using him for this purpose. The king of Assyria does not realize that I am using him and hardening him to discipline my people. This is the passage that uses that verse, shall the axe boast itself above the one who wields it? God himself says, I am wielding the axe of Assyria. I am using them. This is Assyria, this is God. Subjector, subjector, subjector. But God says, yet I will judge the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria. God is going to judge the king of Assyria according to what he thought he was doing in his heart. That's the key. You see? God does still judge. I got to draw another diagram. Please bear with me. I know everybody's hungry, but this is so important that I can't do this message without drawing this diagram. This is a foundation like you have in your house. And it's made a real strong stone. This foundation is, all is out of God. Through Him all things consist. Whether it be for good or for evil, God causes it. This is the foundation. And we believe that and it comforts us. This is the absolute viewpoint. God causes everything. But on top of that foundation is a house. Okay? And we live in the house. The house is the relative viewpoint. We live as if our life depends on what we do. A perfect verse is Philippians 2, 12 and 13. Somebody mentioned it today. Be carrying your own salvation into effect. For it is God working in you to will and to work. Carry your own salvation into effect. Live in the relative. When I drive down the road, I've got to believe it's up to me. I got to stop at the stoplight. I got to make that curve or I'm going to die. If I don't hit this curve, I got to slow down. So I live in the house. I live like it depends on me. But undergirding that, I know that it is really God who is causing me to do what I do. You've got to believe the relative and the absolute. The big mistake comes when you believe the relative at the expense of the absolute. The mistake comes to think that you're working out your salvation by yourself. The mistake comes in thinking that the relative is the absolute. We've got to believe, we've got to live in the relative and believe in the absolute. Don't live in the relative and discard the absolute. I emphasize both. I emphasize both. I know some people, they believe all is of God. But their lives are falling apart. And I exhort these people. I said, brother, get your act together. Send your wife some flowers or something. Something's going wrong, but you got to do something. Am I denying that the absolute exists? No, but for this fella, I have to emphasize the house. I have to emphasize live. Do something. Don't just sit there. And other brothers exhort me the same way, and I expect them to. But underneath it all, I know that God is the undergirding, you see. Now, there's other folks you got to do the opposite with. Some folks think it all depends on them, and they're running around in the house. So these folks, you got to stop them and say, hey, wait a minute, God's causing your every action. Well, you're a really confused person. Yesterday I heard you getting after that guy for not doing anything. Now you're getting after me because I'm doing too much. Both are true. But don't embrace one to deny the other one. The example, who gave? Phil, of Paul in the boat, Paul in the ship, Acts 27. There's a perfect example. God told Paul that every soul on that ship was going to be saved. Person on that ship's going to live. Paul knew that. That's the absolute. But Paul likes to have fun. Paul likes to live. Paul likes to get salt water in his beard. Paul likes to get out and yell at these guys, hey, you dummies! If you don't get up here, you're going to die. Paul is living in the relative, but he's believing in the absolute. One doesn't cancel out the other. They complement each other. The biggest mistake you can make is to separate these. Paul can believe that God is absolute, but at the same time, he's having fun. God could tell me, you're going to have 10 children. That's absolute truth. You know, it might be a little enjoyable to partake in the divine will. You follow me. Live! But don't, while you're living, don't deny that your actions don't have a motivating. Don't deny that there's a power coming. Don't deny that your every action, your every move is from God. Don't deny it. I got so many examples here. Oh, please, can I go 3 minutes over? I've got to. Will you bear with me? Please, because I got to get this out or I'm going to burst. You got to bear with me. I appreciate it. I really do. I'm not going to go this long tonight. But this one is packed, and I've got to get this out. Thank you very much. Do you believe that God apportions people their heartbeats, how many heartbeats they're going to have in their life? Well, David said he sends the Spirit, and he has the keys of death. So he's got it bookended, doesn't he? He has every life bookended. And you know what people used to believe in the Middle Ages? They used to believe that God knew exactly how many heartbeats you were going to have in your life. And that's true, he does. But what they would do is they'd make sure they didn't get too riled up, so they'd preserve them, you know. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they used to believe that. They used to believe that I only have so many heartbeats, so I don't want to get riled up because I don't want to use them up. See? Now, this is what I say to you. I say God does have your heartbeats numbered to the beat because he's a detail God. And I say go out and expend those beats any way you want. Run up the stairs, run up the Washington Monument, because God will cause you to accommodate his pre-planned arrangement. You see what I mean? God, it will cause you, if you want to sit in a chair the rest of your life, go ahead. You will live out your exact amount of heartbeats. If you want to run up the Washington Monument every day, go ahead. You will live out your exact number of heartbeats. You see what I'm saying? People say, if you believe all is of God, why do you still teach? Why do you still try to convince people that of these doctrines? Well, snow is of God too, but we still shovel it off our sidewalks. Snow is of God. Why do you shovel it off your sidewalk? Because I need the exercise. Why do I try to get people to see the Scriptures? Because it's enjoyable. It's fun. It's better than sitting in a chair. But I know that unless God causes them to understand it, they're not going to understand it. But I participate in it because it's fun. It's life. It's living. And Paul was on that ship for the same reason. I'm almost done. This is the wind down. I promise. This is the wind down. I'm going to put that one chart I had up that God is here, but man has this little fly in a jar thing. And I'm going to whittle it down, and I'm going to read some verses, and then I'm done. Who gets the glory for our works? Phil was talking about it, and Brother Coy. Who gets the glory for our works? God's going to get the glory. Ephesians 2:10, his achievement are we. His achievement are we, being created in Christ Jesus for good works. We're his achievement. Uh-oh. That takes a piece out of what we thought we did. Our works, God makes our works ready beforehand that we should be walking in them. Ephesians 2:10. Okay, God, we'll admit God maybe makes them ready beforehand, but we do walk in them, right? Proverbs 20:24. Man's steps are directed by God. Whoops. You can't even walk in the works God has appointed you without God directing your steps. Jeremiah 10:23. Not of man is the going and establishing of his steps. Isaiah 26:12. All our doings thou dost contrive for us. That takes a big chunk of glory away from man. There's another chunk gone. All our doings thou dost contrive for us. Job 23:14. He shall accomplish what is marked out for me. He shall accomplish it. Oh, man. Another piece gone. Psalm 18:33, on my high places, he causes me to stand. There's that darn word cause again. He causes me to stand. Are you standing today in Christ? He caused it. He caused it. Sorry, there's another piece. What? 1 Thessalonians 3:12. Now may the Lord cause you to increase and superabound in love for one another. We all want to have love for one another. Unless God causes you to love, you're not going to love. So much for this. So much for another piece of that sacred circle. Psalm 51:6. You caused me to know wisdom. Did you learn something today? God caused it. Write that down, Psalm 51:6. You caused me to know wisdom. Colossians 1:12. Paul's thanking the Father who makes you competent for a part of the allotment of the saints. Makes you competent. Makes you competent. He makes you competent. Romans 3:27. Where then is boasting? It is the part. And what do you got left? All is of God.
So now let's go. We have time to do this. I'm going to go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 21. There are two different kinds of unbelievers in the world. You've heard me teach this before, probably, but it's on my heart to teach it today. There are worldly unbelievers and there are religious unbelievers, but they have one thing in common. It's the common word there, unbelievers. Paul says, 1 Corinthians 1, verse 21, God delights through the stupidity of the heralding. And we're going to be talking about the cross here again. God delights through the stupidity of the heralding to save those who are believing. And again, we discussed where belief comes from. It's a gift. It's humanly impossible to believe in God. Humanly impossible. Since, in fact, Jews, signs are requesting. This is the religious people. Paul is using Jews and Greeks here as representatives. The Jews are representing the religious contingent, and the Greeks are representing the rest of the world, the nations. And the Jews and the Greeks have two different problems that keep them from believing in Christ. The Jews are looking for a sign. Again, just like Paul says in Philippians 3, to the terrestrial they are disposed. Oh, I got to tell you this. Remember that crazy word in there, the bowels? Their God is their bowels. Philippians 3:18. That's one of the marks, one of the signs of someone who is an enemy of the cross of Christ. Their glory is in their shame, and their God is their bowels. It's like, what's his bowels? It's the compassion. It's the passion. It's the enthusiasm. Free will is your bowel. That's the bowel. The bowels, free will. The human to accomplish, to feel good about something you do. The inner man that longs to express itself. You might as well say that's the definition. I'll just say that's the definition of human free will. Their God is human free will. That's their God. Their God is human free will. They can't imagine that salvation truly is of grace and that humanity comes from one lump of clay. Can't wrap their heads around it. And it's human pride that keeps them from doing that. It's the pride of the flesh. It's being disposed to the terrestrial. And many are walking whose God is their bowels. It doesn't mean they eat a lot of food. Doesn't mean they go to the bathroom a lot. Doesn't mean they love to spend time in the toilet. That's not what that means. It means their God is their passion for Christ. And they have such a passion for Christ that they chose Jesus above all other people. Nobody else had the smarts, the wisdom, the know-how, the common sense. Just believe in Jesus. They did it. They did it. That's their God. Jesus Christ is a Savior in name only. For the enemies of the cross of Christ, the standard, the pole, the torture stake, for the enemies of that stake, salvation by Christ is in name only. Jesus is their God in name only. Their real God is their own gut, their gut feeling, their gut instinct to go with Christ. I went with Christ. I got her done. I went to the altar. I said the sinner's prayer. I pray 10 times a day. I fast during Lent. I go to church every Sunday. What are you talking about? All of that. Let's just say any good act. I'm not calling going to church a good act. I'm just saying any good thing you do comes after the new creation. Comes after the death of Christ. Christ came into the world to save sinners. Did you know that Jesus Christ never saved a believer? Jesus Christ never saved one believer. Paul says, I believe it's 1 Timothy chapter 1, around verse 16, Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, not believers, sinners. How do you save sinners? Because don't you at least have to stop sinning long enough to believe in Jesus? That's the Christian lie. The people who tell you that are enemies. And I know some really sweet, beautiful, loving people, people who are beloved by me, who are enemies of the cross of Christ. That's why Paul lamented. He's not going to be crying his eyes out over some worldly guy who's out, some Barabbas type guy who's out murdering people. Well, that guy's an enemy of the cross. I can't believe it. He's not going to bring him to tears. He's not going to be shocked. He's not going to be writing it down in the scriptures. That's duh, of course. But what makes him cry, and what shocks him, and what he is loath to even write down and tell the Corinthians, is that many are walking. Many are in the circle of those who call themselves believers, who are enemies of the cross, enemies of the death of the old creation. And again, you can spot them a mile away because they're still wrestling with their own flesh and they're still trying to micromanage yours. I pray for all those people. I pray for Marge that she can somehow see the wisdom of God in what I'm doing. She might not see it in this life. She might not see the wisdom of God in this presentation. Any of my writing, any of my work, any of my little jokes, any of my song and dance, I'm not worried about it. I lament. I guess that's different than worrying. I didn't get through what I needed to tell you about the two different kinds of unbelievers. We got started on that. It's worldly unbelievers. That's no shock. It's no shock that there are worldly unbelievers. We all know that. The shock and the lament is that there are religious unbelievers. And we're surrounded by them.